January from The Seasons by Tchaikovsky, played by Lydia Ottemew. And that's about it for this edition of Sunday Morning. I do hope you've enjoyed listening. Next week, my theme will be intermezzos and my featured 20th century harpsichord concerto, a very concise little concertino by Walter Lee. So please do join me same time next Sunday morning at 9 o'clock.
Sunday Morning with Rob Cowan is a unique production for BBC Radio 3, with studio production this morning by Neil Miners.
Radio 3 brings you A Night in the Museum. This evening, live in concert comes not from one of the world's great concert halls, but from the intimate surroundings of Finchcocks, home to a peerless collection of over 100 early keyboard instruments. It's here that Melvin Tan will be playing Mozart and Beethoven piano sonatas on two historic pianos from this hidden gem of a collection. I'm very much looking forward to a fascinating journey of discovery. Just how will the mysterious opening bars of the Moonlight Sonata sound on the sort of piano that Beethoven himself would have known? Join pianist Melvin Tan, the audience at Finchcocks, and me, Martin Handley, to find out live in concert this evening at 7:30 here on BBC Radio 3.
But now it's time for Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the biographer Richard Holmes.
My guest today is a writer obsessed by opium dreams, telescopes, and most recently, balloons. Best known for his biographies of the Romantics, most notably Shelley and Coleridge, Richard Holmes has won just about every literary prize going. In recent years, he's moved towards the history of science with his book, The Age of Wonder, which was hailed widely as the non-fiction book of the year. And his most recent book, Falling Upwards, all about the daring and frequently terrifying adventures of the pioneers of hot air ballooning, is just coming out in paperback. It's a very intriguing read, Falling Upwards, and I think it must have been fun to write because you had to delve into the experience from a personal point of view, didn't you?
That's right. I mean, it's kind of an unconventional history of ballooning, and it does start with me, I forget, aged about four or something, being taken by my Royal Air Force uncle to a little village in Norfolk, which is close to where I now finally live, and having a little helium toy party balloon tied to my top button and thinking at the age of four that I was going to float away and holding on to his hand. And my pilot uncle sort of just said something calmly like, Richard, I think you might fly. And then let go of my hand. And that's how the book begins, at this idea of actually falling upwards. But then it's a way of telling the stories of a group of people, men and women, who fascinate me, who are partly scientific people, partly show people, but also quite a lot literary people, people who want to write about the experience. So it was a wonderful way to choose a kaleidoscope of experiences.
You had quite a close call when you went up subsequently in a balloon, didn't you?
Yes, that was the American one in New Mexico at Albuquerque, where I went up on the what's called the mass dawn ascent, which is 400 hot air balloons all going up at dawn simultaneously from an enormous field outside Albuquerque. D.H. Lawrence's house is just up the road. We actually collided with another balloon.
Wow.
My pilot was a woman pilot who just won the American Challenge gas balloon cup. So I thought, as we collided, I looked at her and her face was completely expressionless. It's interesting. And I thought, either it means it's fine, there's no problem, or we're going to die and that's how we approach this. And actually what happened was they just bounced away. And it makes a good story, but it's true. The balloons, all black balloon, so south, deep south, they're all named, these balloons. And this balloon, as it turned, its nameplate came to view, and it was Jesus Saves. Oh, yes.
Your first choice of music takes us not only back to your childhood, but also back to the 13th century.
That's right. It's interesting, the whole question of how you choose, what kind of hooks and eyes of memory they produce. And I did want to go really far back, from the age of 8 to the age of 17, I was at Roman Catholic boarding schools, which did have a big impact on me, I think. It's partly where the first music I heard was liturgical music. And this particular plain chant, and it is original 13th century, Dies Irae, and it's an extraordinary piece, absolutely haunting. It means the day of wrath, and the whole thing is about the last judgment and death. And so at an 8-year-old, I was being faced with that, which in its own way was actually quite good. But to me, the words are absolutely hypnotic and the rhythm is completely hypnotic. And it produces this kind of dream state, partly beautiful and partly terrifying. And that really interested me.
The Dies Irae from the Gregorian Plain Chant Requiem Mass, performed by the monks of l'Abbaye Saint-Pierre de Solesmes. It's sort of perfect, that, isn't it? I mean, it needs nothing else.
No, we're both sort of swaying gently to that. It conjures such images of a darkened sort of interior of a cathedral, few candles lit, and these cowled, dark figures singing. But I think the Roman Catholic Church no longer sing it. It's not part of the formal, because it's regarded as a bit too demanding and fierce and menacing. But striking for
us. I'm very interested, Richard Holmes, that you mentioned the slightly double-edged sword of this Catholic upbringing.
Yes, I still feel quite mixed about it, actually. I think it was the schools were wonderful for academic teaching. And my sort of love of reading and history and English and deep French came out of that education. But there was a big intellectual and emotional struggle to what I think of as scrambling out of the whole set of Catholic beliefs and doctrine, which mostly happened to me between the ages of 15 and 17, and are partly associated with France as well. That's the first time, really, I was aware of making a real intellectual effort to grapple with this, very much a sense of freeing myself intellectually from that.
Well, you mentioned France, and that has been very important to you in lots of ways, hasn't it?
Oh, yes, France, almost at the same time. I was first taken to France by my parents in an old Woolsey car, and used to drive through the vine fields, and I learnt a tiny bit of French there. So that was a wonderful beginning. And then later, I went there on my own, indeed, at 17, 18, down to the south, to the Cévennes region. And I was on my own for about 6 months down there, learned French and learned a whole lot of other things also about writing. And for me, France is the other place, the other language, freedom and lightness, sun, love, romance, all that's France for me.
And even now, you and Rose Tremaine have a house there.
Absolutely. Meeting Rose, well, which was, in fact, in February 24th, I think, 1992, was absolutely a sort of vital moment in my life. And one of the things we discovered is that she'd been educated at the Sorbonne. We both knew France from different angles. And we both loved the literature. And I took her down to the Cévennes. And she fell in love with it too. Indeed, she's written a very good novel about it called Trespass. And yes, finally, we bought one of those slightly wrecked stone houses. Nothing too grand, but lovely in the middle of vine fields. And very gradually, we've had it for 12 years, I think. We've reconstructed it and we work down there. We can write down there. And also, I can prune my olive trees down there. I have to say, I fell out an olive tree the other year and tore my cartilage. and when I went to the NHS, the wonderful doctor said, "How do you do this?" I said, "I fell out of an olive tree." And his eyebrows raised. "What were you doing in an olive tree at your age?" He fixed it very quickly.
So while you were pruning olives, yeah, might this be the kind of music that would come into your mind?
Lots of things, but particularly a thing that's really stayed with me are the wonderful Chants d'Auvergne, the Cantaloupe, a whole series of them. And we play them formally on Christmas morning. I always put on the disc. They're the exact opposite of the Dies Irae. They're light. They're full of joy and life. And I've chosen actually the very first one, The Shepherdess in the Fields. It's a little story. And again, music for me, what fascinates me is the stories in some way encompassed, whether they're songs or not. And this is a very simple story, which goes like this. There's a little shepherdess, and she's in the field somewhere in the south, I imagine, with her sheep. And a fine gentleman, a monsieur, rides by on his fancy horse. And he says, "Oh, how pretty you are, my dear," etc., etc. And she says, "Oh, that's very charming of you. Why don't you get off your horse and tie it to this tree and come and talk to me?" So he does, and he thinks he's got it made. He's going to seduce his maiden. But at the end of the song, she suddenly laughs at him, having got him off his horse, and skips away into the meadow. So it's a complete little drama with this wonderful end. And right at the end, there is this whoops sound, which to me is a kind of, it's so French, it's wonderful. wonderful, that wonderful escape. And the tra-la-la, she's teasing him all the time. It's so good. Interesting about the language, because that's a sort of a Vanois patois. So the English translations, the French translations, all different. There's something important that you don't sort of necessarily have to understand it. The drama and the poetry still works. It also reminds me that the accents of the South and the Cévennes is very different. And I still can do je vais chercher du pain à Saint-Quentin. It's got a little twang of the Cévennes. So that's the kind of rootedness. I subsequently discovered that Cantaloupe went round, like, was it Cecil Sharp who went collecting all the English folk songs? And Cantaloupe went round the Auvergne. He was born in the Auvergne. And it must be in the 1920s. He had a very early recorder. So he recorded this and then built the songs around it. Incidentally, I also think I didn't know until quite recently, he was born in Annonay, which is the site of the very first French air balloon took off there, 1782.
Kyrie Kanawa performing La Pastoura from Cantaloupe's Songs of the Auvergne. Geoffrey Tate conducted the English Chamber Orchestra. Yes, that thing of collecting folk songs has got a very wonderful tradition. I mean, one thinks of composers as various as Bartok in Hungary, Messiaen Birdsong in France, Vaughan Williams, Cecil Sharp. I've even done it myself in Greece.
Have you?
For me, it was like having a camera, or for you, having a notebook, yes. I guess.
That thing of collecting stories, sort of life stories in song, it's kind of field work, isn't it? That interests me, and it's very close to the thing that I do anyway, biographically, professionally.
I like to be in America next.
Yes. This is another kind of escape thing. People talk about the 60s. For me, the 60s began when I was taken by my father, quite uncharacteristically in a way. He took me to the original theatre production in London. I was aged either 14 or 15. Of West Side Story. It was a knockout as far as I was concerned. I can see it now. It was something to do with the life, the animation, the dance, the clothes they wear, the jeans, those wonderful bomber jackets, the singing, of course, it's Romeo and Juliet, the passion in it.
It's not sentimental like some musicals, is it?
I know. And, of course, a lot of the musicals that I heard first were on my parents' radiogram, you know, South Pacific and all that. And this was something completely different. But the one I picked was the America song, which is, again, has a little drama in it, which is the two girls, Anita, I think, and Rosalie, and they're talking about the difference between Puerto Rico, where they come from, and the wonders of America, the American dream. And it's this little exchange, this little duet that goes on with these amazingly snappy words. It's the speed and the irony and the wit of the exchange. It's so American.
Streaming and the natives steaming. I like the island Manhattan.
I know you do.
Smoke on your pipe and put that in.
I like to be in America. Okay, by me in America. Everything free in America.
For a small fee in America.
Okay.
And credit is so nice.
One look at us and they charge twice.
I have my own washing machine.
What will you have though to keep clean?
Skyscrapers bloom in America.
Cadillacs zoom in America.
Industry boom in America.
Wealth in a room in America.
Lots of new housing with more space.
Lots of doors slamming in our face.
I'll get a terrace apartment.
Better get rid of your accent.
Life can be bright in America.
If you can fight in America.
Life is all right in America.
if you're all white in America.
San Juan.
I know a boat you can get on. Bye-bye.
Everyone there will give big cheers.
Hey! Everyone there will have moved here.
Michael, we were almost dancing around the room, actually, with that. It's absolutely fantastic. It's still got it, that fantastic bounce and life going on. And they were dancing on the tabletops. They were flashing their skirts. The boys were... It's a wonderful, wonderful piece. And also, you'd know about this. Is there sort of kind of Gershwin-like sounds in there somehow, yeah, with that American, the way, and the beats are very complicated, aren't they, playing against each other?
Well, the rhythm is absolutely quintessential, and quite often it's syncopated, but it's just very cool.
It's very cool, but also hot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I Like to Be in America from the Bernstein musical West Side Story, with lyrics by Stephen Sondheim. Richard Holmes, you studied English at Cambridge and then moved to London, where you began, I think, writing for The Times and published a volume of poetry. But it wasn't long before you were drawn to biography.
After writing a book of poems and Life of Shelley, which was when I really sort of discovered what this was about, it took me best part of 5 years. For the first half, I worked for The Times, and I gave everything up. I bought a military camp bed, which I slept on because I was on campaign, okay, for writing this book. And I went everywhere he went, starting Ireland and Scotland and then to France and then to Italy. And I went all those places, lived quite rough there, and wrote that book.
It was a brave choice in some ways, wasn't it? Because I suppose Shelley was not in the 70s incredibly in fashion.
No, which is one of the reasons I chose him. I'd never studied him at university. Remember, this is kind of 60s and that kind of political idealism, which has almost slipped away now, and the idea that we could all live in communes. And it was quite powerful then. I took it probably rather naively. And it seemed to me the Shelley story, his band of adventurers and the chaotic love life and all that, that seemed to me a very interesting combination of politics and poetry and sexual liberation and travel and adventure. And it was just wonderful to write about.
So did you go to Lerici?
God, did I go to Lerici? You bet. Most searches I try and do in the winter because there's no tourists there. And I arrived fairly penniless and I met somebody in a bar who said, oh, there's a woman who's got a boarding house on the seafront. And the room I got was a huge balcony room. And next door was the Casa Magni, where Shelley had lived the last months of his life. So I could lean over the balcony and look into his house. So that was one of those wonderful breaks you get. But
good, he drowned near there.
He did, absolutely. And he went just down the coast and he was sailing back in this new boat with his great friend, Edward Williams, and an English boat boy who we know very little about. And all three of them drowned. And it was a slight craziness, really, because they sailed into a storm and there's evidence that they wouldn't take the sails down and so on. And I realise now that it was reckless, he's saying, but his whole life was reckless. I subsequently, indeed, coming back sailing with some friends across the channel on sort of wild early autumn day, and a lot of things went wrong with the boat, and we were on the east coast where, in fact, the wreck of the Deutschland was. And our boat was wrecked on one of those sandbanks. And we were in the sea, and we were picked up out of the sea by air sea rescue helicopter. And the real thing about that, it was quite an experience. I wouldn't have missed it. We were all right, but it was, you see life very differently when you've been through an experience like that. When we got into the wonderful headquarters there on the North Foreland of the air sea rescue, who are wonderful people in there, and they had a whole wonderful illuminated dial of this with the thing of where our boat had hit the bank. And they had got our name somehow already. And the controller said to me, oh, yes, we've been looking up, Mr. Holmes. You wrote that book about Shelley. Isn't this taking it a bit far? Oh, God.
Well, you mentioned Paris. We're going to go there now for a very distinctive composer in a way.
Uh-huh. Yes, this is Satie. And this is the, I suppose now very well known, the Gymnopédie, the first of those, which is basically a very distinctive, what I'd call solitary piano piece with this sort of fragmented, tumbling rhythm. And I connect it with the really weeks, months I was there of walking around, learning Paris all by myself. Very, very lonely period. It was after the Shelley book. A lot of the time was spent simply walking around Paris, going to the libraries. And this music played in my head. And it's kind of, to me, it's like research music. It's reflecting, thinking on what you're doing, and out of the loneliness, certain things happen. It is quite romantic, I think. It's quite melancholy, quite complicated for me.
Thank you.
research and writing is something like that. That placing of the notes, that sort of hesitant placing. One thing I discovered there, a technique I've always used afterwards, I always use notebooks. And on the right-hand side of my notebooks is the research material I'm going in, the facts, as it were, I'm discovering about somebody. And on the left-hand side is one's own reactions, which might be dreams or things you met in the street or thoughts or indeed pieces of music. So you've got this vernacular piece of research going on. And somehow the sati is that. It incorporates that anyway.
Pascal Roger played the first of Satie's three gymnopédies. And you can find details of all of Richard Holmes's choices on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. You said very interestingly, I think, Richard, that your business as a biographer is not merely finding the facts of a life, but finding the tunes, the tune that underlies and unifies them. And it's interesting you chose a musical analogy there.
But you're looking for a tune in a different way. You're looking for what unites a life. What are the themes that gradually come out? And in quite complicated ways, people like Shelley, who had short lives, he died before he was 30. It's a kind of single arc, a sort of burning rocket-like arc, which you're following. But if you, when I was writing about Coleridge, for example, who lived into his 60s, part of the interest of the biography, he lives long enough to begin to look back as himself as a young man and indeed write about it. So again, this sort of binocular vision is introduced. And it is definitely a musical analogy. And gradually, when I begin to hear what is a tune, what I call the tune, the melodic line, that's the same as discovering in a life, this is the kind of theme that pulls it together. And it takes a long time to do that. And you have, it's not just a question of the right-hand page, the technical research. It's your emotional understanding of that person. That has to go into it.
The next song has an almost ironic romanticism to it, doesn't it?
This is the Erlkönig. It's a Goethe ballad, written just before, and this is partly why I chose it, the time of Coleridge's Ancient Mariner. And 10 years before, roughly, or 1780 or so, Goethe developed this story. I think it's a Danish tale. And it's very mysterious, and mysteries in stories are very always interesting. The simple story is there is a figure riding through the night on a horse. And he has with him his son, which he's holding in his arms. And he's riding very fast to get somewhere, to get home, probably, all right? And as he rides through the night, this voice suddenly rises, and it's the sinister Earl King who begins to talk to the child and says, "Leave your father, come away with me. All my daughters want to play with you. They're so beautiful. We'll give you lovely clothes. My wife will mother you." And the father can't hear this, only the child can hear it. So in the ballad, you get the three voices, the father talking to the child, my son, and then the Earl King in this very light, seductive, insinuating voice saying, come with me, and then the child saying, father, my father, the king is trying to take him away, and in the end, the father can't see the king, but when he arrives home with the child, is dot. The child is dead. And it's got this very fierce romantic ballad ending. Bang, the child is dead. No explanation. No explanation of why the Erlkönig could do this. Why couldn't the father see the Erlkönig? It's a very enigmatic, powerful, and quite violent, essentially romantic ballad. The sense of something almost mesmeric in it.
Oh.
Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau singing Schubert's Der Erlkönig with Gerald Moore playing the piano. In 2008, Richard Holmes, you published The Age of Wonder and subtitled How the Romantic Generation Discovered the Beauty and Terror of Science. What was it about the meeting of the romantic and the scientific imaginations that so fascinated you?
I think this all came about from writing about Coleridge, who is the most fascinating person to write about. And one of the many events in his life, quite early on, that he meets a very young man called Humphrey Davy, who's going to be the most brilliant chemist and scientist of the day. So they're both in their 20s. And Davy is at the Bristol Pneumatic Institute, and he's experimenting with nitrous oxide, laughing gas, which he thinks may be a universal cure for tuberculosis. Very interesting. That's why he does it. He's testing the effects, as in modern science, and he calls in various people to try it, volunteers. One of them is the poet Coleridge. It's a wonderful combination. Coleridge has just written the opium poem, Kubla Khan. And they're wonderful accounts of this testing. And in fact, what Davy discovers, and Coleridge realizes this, is that nitrous oxide has anesthetic properties. There was no concept of anesthesia at this point. We're talking 1799, 1800, okay? And Davy writes his paper saying this gas could be used in surgery and people would feel nothing. And that was never explored for the next 40 years. Mm-hmm. So all the amputations in the Napoleonic Wars and so on. So it's a very interesting moment in science. And I realised that that generation of Davy and Herschel, the great astronomer, were making breakthroughs, but were working within a romantic culture. So I wanted to write a book which turned out to be quite a big book, about the kind of interface, how the poets and the scientists met, what effect they had each other, literally from kind of the letters and things they exchanged to things like Byron looking through Herschel's telescope and so on. And I also realized that I was writing about this terrible thing, the two cultures, this awful division that particularly in England has really damaged our education system and so on for two generations. And the book is an attempt to completely destroy the idea of two cultures. There aren't two cultures. Science and literature and arts talk to each other where they must.
And how wonderful that those two things do come together in our next piece, because Herschel, of course, was not only a very well-known astronomer, but he was also a composer.
William Herschel was, of course, a German born in Hanover, worked in the military bands there, then came over to England, immigrant here, and he worked in bands all over England, and then finally went to Bath, where he was appointed the official organist of the Bath Octagon Chapel. And then he did a very interesting thing. He brought his younger sister, Caroline, over to England. She was still in Hanover being bullied by their parents. And the moment she was 21, he brought her over so she could pursue a career as an opera singer. But she also fell in love with astronomy as he did. And he started building telescopes. And in 1781, after he'd been in Bath, so I don't know, 15 or so years, he discovered a new planet with his homemade telescope, which is Uranus, the seventh planet. And this piece of music, it summarizes all that. It's somehow him, the oboe player, teaching Caroline astronomy. I can't quite explain this, but it begins, it's like a little demonstration. Here's this almost like a dance tune, and gradually it gets more complicated, exactly as she did, and she became a very good astronomer, comet discoverer in her own right.
But also, you could say that looking through the telescope,
yes,
you see something which perhaps to the naked eye looks quite simple, and then as you magnify it, you see the complexity of what is going on.
That's absolutely right. And I realised that his sort of technical skills and delights were exchangeable between music, and he played all the instruments, and his telescope astronomy. And I have to say, again, following the route, Rose bought me a beautiful reflector telescope. So I learned how difficult, basically, it is to make his kind of reading. So that all this is tied up, and behind it's the final wonderful idea of the music of the spheres, because that's what the astronomy is doing.
Thank you.
The third movement of William Herschel's Oboe Concerto in C major. Richard Woodhams was playing the oboe and Davis Jerome was conducting the Mozart Orchestra. Richard Holmes, we're going to revisit America, but this time it's thanks really to your partner, the writer Rose Tremain.
Absolutely. Rose, as I probably said before, I met in February 1992, so we've been living together for 22 years. She'd just come back from teaching in Nashville, Tennessee. And she came back with country music, and we completely fell in love with it. I picked this Ode to Billy Joe, who it's sung by a singer who's known probably as Bobby Gentry, but her real name is Roberta Lee Streeter, which I love that, Miss Streeter. And to me, it sums up so much of country music. First of all, it's a story. It's another of these mysteries. Probably a story about love lost and about grief and also about how life is tough and careless. And it tells an entire story of a family in about six stanzas. And there's a mystery, which is, why did Billy Joe jump off the Tallahassee Bridge?
It was the 3rd of June, another sleepy, dusty Delta day. I was out chopping cotton and my brother was baling hay. And at dinner time we stopped and walked back to the house to eat. And Mama hollered at the back door, y'all remember to wipe your feet. And then she said, I got some news this morning from Choctaw Ridge. Today Billy Joe McAllister jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge. And Papa said to Mama as he passed around the black-eyed peas, well, Billy Joe never had a lick of sense. Pass the biscuits, please. There's 5 more acres in the lower 40 I got to plow. And Mama said it was a shame about Billy Joe anyhow. Seems like nothing ever comes to no good up on Choctaw Ridge. And now Billy Joe McAllister's jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge. Brother said he recollected when he and Tom and Billy Joe put a frog down my back at the Carroll County Picture Show. And wasn't I talking to him after church last Sunday night? I'll have another piece of apple pie, you know it don't seem right. I saw him at the sawmill yesterday on Choctaw Ridge. And now you tell me Billy Joe's jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge. Mama said to me, child, what's happened to your appetite? Well, I've been cooking all morning and you haven't touched a single bite. That nice young preacher, Brother Taylor, dropped by today. Said he'd be pleased to have dinner on Sunday. Oh, by the way, he said he saw a girl that looked a lot like you up on Choctaw Ridge. And she and Billy Joe was throwing something off the Tallahatchie Bridge. A year has come and gone since we heard the news about Billy Joe. Brother married Becky Thompson, they bought a store in Tupelo. There was a virus going round. Papa caught it and he died last spring. And now Mama doesn't seem to want to do much of anything. And me, I spend a lot of time picking flowers up on Choctaw Ridge and drop them into the muddy water off the Tallahatchie Bridge.
So, another of these, it's a folk song really, isn't it? And it sounds like a real story, but it's so many mysteries there. What did the two of them, what were they seen throwing off the bridge? And I think that there are websites to explain what, you know, wedding ring, a gun, what could it have been? But obviously it's something about a love affair that's gone wrong, it's forbidden in some ways.
Bobby Gentry's Ode to Billy Joe. Are you working on anything at the moment?
I'm going to take the Age of Wonder a little bit further into the early Victorian period, which will be also French and American, pre-Darwin. One of the things that really interests me now is as science, geology and astronomy, as it were, kick in, we get deep time, deep space, and then the whole question of religious belief, how is that affected by that? So that would include Charles Lyell's book on geology, but also Tennyson's In Memoriam, which is a poem about the death of his great friend Hallam, but it's also about the death of religious belief and how science has challenged that.
Well, let's end with balloons. Mm. Let's take off, as it were, because you've chosen music, which was very much created to conjure up this feeling. And after documenting your own rather hazardous trips in balloons and near disasters, I just must ask you first, do you ever dare go in one again? Would you?
Oh, yes. I have to tell you, much to Rosie's horror, this spring, a balloon arrived at the edge of the vine field just alongside our house. I got photographs of it. So they're obviously calling for me, I think. No, I will. But research takes you wherever, yeah.
And this music is from the film of Ian McEwan's novel Enduring Love, which has one of the most memorable first chapters, because it's all about somebody hanging on to a balloon which then takes off, and this person has to decide whether to let go.
That's right.
Or to hang on.
It's a wonderful book, Enduring Love. I admire Ian's fictions after Roses, and I think that's a fantastic book, and it made a very successful film. And the whole opening, it's the opening two chapters and of the film too, is about this balloon taking off with a child in it. There's so many legends about balloons take off with a child in it, and the one man who holds on, everybody else drops off. So it's a kind of moral choice as well as a metaphysical choice, physical one. And to that film, there was this beautiful music, which we also used when my book was read on the radio.
Falling Upwards.
And to me, it's got a touch of Vaughan Williams in it, I think.
The Lark Ascending.
And it's this mixture of departure, and it's full of hope, this piece of music. And that, to me, is, I think, one of the reasons why I write biography, because I want to write about the story of hope in all kinds of people's lives. And a balloon taking off is a kind of perfect image of this. And this piece of music has just got that as it sails away.
Richard Holmes, thank you very much.
Oh, well, Michael, thank you. I really enjoyed that, and pity we didn't do a bit more dancing around here.
Christopher Austin conducting the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra in balloon music from Jeremy Sams's soundtrack to the film Enduring Love. And that ends today's edition of Private Passions. Michael Barclay's guest was the biographer Richard Holmes. The producer was Jane Greenwood, and it was a Loftus production for BBC Radio 3. And details of all of Richard Holmes's musical choices are on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website, where you can also download a free podcast of the programme. Well, Private Passions returns in 2 weeks' time when Michael's guest will be the actress Phyllida Law. Very good afternoon to you. From me, Ian Skelly, I'm here to guide you through a summer's afternoon of music on Radio 3. Live music from the big weekend at the Early Music Festival in York in an hour from now. Andrew Parrott has just received a Lifetime Achievement Award at the festival for his work in the early music world. He'll be one of the guests talking to Lucy Skeeping. Plenty of performances too during the programme. That's at 2 o'clock. And in just a couple of minutes' time on Radio 3, our lunchtime concert today is a programme of songs by Schubert at Wigmore Hall in London, the tenor Mark Padmore teaming up with the pianist Julius Drake. That's after a summary of the BBC News this lunchtime at 1 o'clock. It's read by David Cornett.
Israel has warned Palestinians in the north of Gaza to leave their homes before it begins more airstrikes. Ground troops have entered Gaza for the first time since an offensive began on Tuesday in response to rocket attacks on Israeli territory from Hamas militants. Palestinian officials say at least 165 people have been killed in airstrikes by Israel. The UN has called for a ceasefire. The business secretary, Vince Cable, says foreign companies will face fines if they fail to abide by promises on jobs when they take over a British firm. The change is being planned after concerns were raised about assurances made by the US drugs company Pfizer during its failed bid for the British-based business AstraZeneca. The Pope has said he believes the celibacy rule for Catholic priests could eventually be relaxed. In an interview with the Italian newspaper La Repubblica, Pope Francis pointed out that the rule was adopted 900 years after the death of Jesus. A Vatican spokesman has said he'd been misquoted. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, has told the BBC it's important for the Church of England to accept female bishops. Members of its ruling body, the Synod, will cast their final vote on the issue tomorrow. Russia has warned of possible irreversible consequences after it claimed that a shell fired from Ukrainian territory killed one man and injured two people. Russia described the incident in the town of Donetsk, near the border with eastern Ukraine, as an aggressive act by Ukraine on its land and people. Millions of television viewers are expected to watch this evening's World Cup final in Rio de Janeiro, where Germany will face Argentina. It's been a hugely disappointing tournament for the host country, Brazil, whose team was beaten 3-0 by the Netherlands yesterday in the third place playoff. And the weather, it'll be a cloudy day in central and eastern parts with outbreaks of rain, locally heavy. There'll be drier, brighter and fresher conditions in the west, although the risk of heavy, possibly thundery, slow-moving showers remains for eastern parts. BBC News and weather at 1:02.
David, thank you very much. Now it's time for another chance to hear last Monday's live lunchtime concert here on Radio 3. It was presented by Sarah Moore Peach.
Hello and welcome to Wigmore Hall, where a great leader partnership, Mark Padmore and Julius Drake, have drawn in quite a crowd. They're about to perform an all-Schubert programme, focusing in the main on Schubert's settings of one poet, Johann Gabriel Seidel. He was also Austrian, like Schubert, a few years younger, and as well as being a poet and dramatist, he was also an archaeologist. The first three Seidel settings we're going to hear are Wanderer und den Mond, Im Freien and Irdisches Glück. And there's a particular quality of simplicity to Schubert's settings of Seidel, particularly in the piano parts, which are often repetitive and hypnotic. You'll hear the piano imitating the tread of the wanderer's feet in the first song, for example, as the wanderer addresses the moon. The second song is another romantic archetype, a figure standing outside in the evening air, dreaming of his beloved's face at her window. And the third song we'll hear in this set is Earthly Happiness, looking forward to the moment of death and the possibility of being surrounded at that moment by good friends. Here are Mark Padmore and Julius Drake to begin their Schubert recital with Der Wanderer und den Mond, the wanderer addressing the moon.
Welt am Himmel, du, wir wandern beide rüstig zu. Ich ernst und trüb, du mild und rein, was mag der Unterschied wohl sein? Land zu Land, zu heimatlos, so unbekannt. Berg auf, Berg ab, Wald ein, Wald aus, doch bin ich nirgend, ach, zu Haus. Du aber wanderst auf und ab, aus Ostens Weg in Westens Grab. Wallst Länder ein und Länder aus und bist doch, wo du bist, zu Haus. Der Himmel endlos ausgespannt ist dein geliebtes Heimatland. O glücklich wer, wohin er geht, noch auf der Heimatboden steht. Glücklich wer, wohin er geht, doch auf der Heimatboden steht. Auf der Heimatboden steht.
Augen, die mir gut.
Liebster Freund.